What is a recession anyway? And here's a hint, by the way, it is not two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth anymore. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ruzdal. It is Monday, the 29th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A word as we begin today. One single word that is being thrown around a lot in economic analysis and reporting of late, and as such, needs a little splaining. Recession, of course. Recession, never a pleasant thing, but one part of a reasonably predictable economic cycle. But it occurred to us the other day that for a whole lot of people, their only experience with an economy in decline is the Great Recession. And the fact is, that is not what most economic slowdowns are like. Marketplace's Jack Stewart starts us off.
Many people in their 20s and 30s have grown up with the repercussions of the Great Recession of a decade ago seared into their memories. Rodney Duncan from Los Angeles is 24.
I do remember while I was in school, a lot of people were losing houses. I remember people losing their jobs. I remember my uncle, he used to work at the hospital, and he told me at least 300 people lost their job there.
That recession was a particularly bad one. The subprime mortgage crisis led to repossessions and plummeting house prices. Some of the US's biggest banks needed bailouts. The stock market dropped, wiped thousands off people's 401k savings. So, yeah, something to worry about.
It's very natural that the word recession makes us very nervous.
Ataman Ozildurm is Director of Economic Research at the Conference Board.
We often say every recession is different, although recessions themselves recur and have common sequences. So just because we had a very deep recession in 2008 doesn't necessarily mean the next recession will be like that.
Some are actually quite brief, and they're not all as violent as the Great Recession. They're defined as a period when the economy stops growing and starts shrinking. One measure of that is when the gross domestic product declines for 6 months in a row. But economists look at retail sales, incomes, and employment too. Measures that Sarah Cohen and Lenore Sanchez can relate to, having seen layoffs at work in the last recession.
We've been through it before. We know what to do.
What do you do? I think a lot of people would like that advice.
Spend wisely. Spend what you make.
Stay to the necessities, not the wants.
And know that even if there is a recession, there is eventually a recovery. And hopefully the next one won't leave as many long-lasting memories. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
One reason a lot of people are talking recession right now is that while the U.S. economy is doing all right, much of the rest of the world isn't, as we've been telling you. There are slowdowns brewing in China and in Europe, two of our biggest trading partners. So as the governors of the Federal Reserve get set to meet tomorrow and Wednesday with that global economy firmly top of mind, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has some context.
Several decades ago, a slowdown in Asia or Europe likely wouldn't have spurred the Federal Reserve to try to boost growth by stimulating the U.S. economy. But after the global financial crisis and Great Recession, says Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics,
we've seen how integrated the United States is with all areas of the global economy. We're seeing signs of a pretty worrying slowdown in Europe, something of a slowdown in Asia too. And I think the Fed's concern is that that could spill over into the U.S.
The U.S. economy has already been slowing down this year without any help from the rest of the planet, thanks in part to the fading effects of the 2017 tax cuts. Now, says economist Joe Bruswellis at RSM Consulting, the Trump administration's escalating tariffs on imports and other countries' retaliatory tariffs on our exports have exposed U.S. farmers and manufacturers to increased economic risk.
That uncertainty tax caused by trade policy and those tariffs caused business fixed investment to contract by 5.5% in the second quarter.
Bruswellis says U.S. manufacturing is already on the brink of recession, and the Fed's worried the global slowdown could send it over the edge. Meanwhile, multinational companies have been scrambling to shift their production away from China to countries facing lower U.S. tariffs, says Columbia University political economist Sharon O'Halloran.
A lot of those jobs from China are moving to Vietnam, to Cambodia, moving partly to Mexico.
All of that churn in worldwide supply chains is disruptive and costs money, and may be one reason for the recent slowdown in global growth. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Mitchell was talking about tariffs. Well, to that point, trade talks between the U.S. and China pick up again on Tuesday. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer are going to be in Shanghai. These will be the first face-to-face talks in something like 2 months. Marketplace's John Buckley has the update there.
There are many issues to wrestle with in these talks, as in the previous rounds. How much progress can we expect? We don't know. I'm John Buckley for Marketplace.
I mean, come on, right? This will be, by the way, back to the Fed for a second. Assuming it happens, the first time in more than a decade that the Fed has cut interest rates. Send us your questions about what the Fed is doing and why. We will get them answered as many as we can. Anyway, there's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. On Wall Street, this last Monday in July, everybody's pretty much waiting for the Fed. To be honest, no sense getting ahead of Jay Powell. Et al. Will have the details when we do the numbers. We did an explainer on Friday about the U.S. dollar, its strength at the moment, and why the greenback is so strong. Timing on that one was pretty good, actually, because the White House spent a good part of Friday sending mixed messages about whether it's going to intervene in the foreign exchange markets. Not yet, seems to be the current state of affairs, but a president of the United States even talking about trying to weaken the dollar is unusual. Catherine Dominguez is a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you help me understand why the president wants to weaken the dollar? I mean, all the time you hear administrations talking strong dollar, not this one.
Right. No, this is a change. He has in the past also suggested that a weaker dollar would help the trade balance. I think it really comes down to his concerns about the trade dispute we currently have with China and other countries and his view that it would expand our exports and lower our imports.
Let me roll together a couple of stories that are in the news. The first is the White House talking about the currency, and the second is the Fed meeting coming up tomorrow and Wednesday. Help me understand why the president is leaning on Jay Powell in terms of the value of the American dollar.
Sure. He would like the Fed to come up with a larger than 25 basis point cut.
Right. Quarter percentage point for the lay people out there.
Thank you. And the larger the cut, the less attractive is the U.S. dollar. So it's more likely that the dollar would fall in value. So the two are very much connected.
Now, it's not like the United States has never intervened in the currency markets before, right? We're not, you know, pure as driven snow here.
Absolutely. And in fact, the U.S. was a fairly significant intervener in the 1980s and to some extent the 1990s. But we have not intervened for the purpose of affecting the dollar for a long time.
Do you hear other countries out there, Japan, Great Britain, members of the European Union, are they coming out and saying, oh, the dollar definitely needs to be weaker? We need to help the United States out?
No. And in fact, that's a real issue. The last time that the U.S. successfully brought down the dollar was the Plaza Agreement. And you have to go all the way back to 1985 for that. And that was a time period where all the central banks you just mentioned did agree that the dollar was overvalued. And they all agreed to sell dollars together. And it was a very successful coordinated intervention. At this point, I don't see that happening.
Can we talk two other currencies here besides the dollar just really quickly since they are somewhat in the news? The first is the British pound, which I'm sure you saw is trading at multi-year lows here in the wake of Boris Johnson taking over. What, if anything, should observers read into that?
I think that's all about no-deal Brexit. I think the odds of a no-deal Brexit have gone up. The general assessment is that is not good for the British economy, and therefore the value of the pound is going down.
And since the market always knows best, how much do you read into that?
You never know. I would say that there's some negotiating going on between Boris Johnson and the EU, and that could go up and down.
Okay, so over to the EU. One of the things the president has been complaining about is that other central banks are acting on behalf of their currency. The European Central Bank said the other day, look, we are ready to provide more interest rate accommodation. We're ready to lower interest rates if need be. How important is the euro in this conversation?
So that's right. Mario Draghi made a statement in September, even though recently they decided to leave the interest rate unchanged, that they may well decide to cut. And Trump is using that statement that Draghi made as an opening for him to likewise state that if they're driving down the euro, we'll drive down the dollar.
Right. So spitball it for me here. We're going to get the Fed cutting rates on Wednesday, probably by a quarter of a percentage point. The White House is, at least for now, not openly going to intervene. Where do we go from here with this currency conversation?
It'll be interesting to see. If all goes as expected, my guess is that we will have this conversation over and over again, depending a little on how things go with the trade negotiations.
Right. Catherine Dominguez, she's a professor of public policy and economics at the Ford School at the University of Michigan. Thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've got that explainer I mentioned about the dollar and its strengths online at marketplace.org. In pharmacological news today, generics. Pfizer says it's going to combine its off-brand division with the EpiPen manufacturer Mylan and create a whole business focused on drugs that have lost their patent protections. The theory being that Pfizer would then be able to focus on patented and more profitable medicines, including conceivably cancer treatments. Cancer drugs have never been cheap, but in the oh-so-pricey world of big pharma, oncology drugs are among the most expensive. And where high dollar amounts are on the line, the various business interests involved become more sharply defined. Blake Farmer of WPLN in Nashville reports now on the fight between cancer doctors and pharmacy benefit managers.
There's nothing immediately impressive about the shelves of medication I'm looking at, except that they're worth millions of dollars.
This is a $19,000 bottle.
And these pill bottles are what pharmacist Stacy McCullough calls the battleground. Because of the price, the medications are sold only in specialty pharmacies and are closely monitored by the entity paying the bill, known as a pharmacy benefit manager, or PBM. They decide which drugs an employer will pay for. Now, they also run their own specialty pharmacies, so they're selling cancer drugs too. Big oncology practices also sell cancer drugs. Perhaps you can see where this fight over these pricey pills is heading. Cancer clinics and PBMs weren't so much at odds back when chemotherapy required IV infusions. But these days, chemo can often be delivered through oral medication, easily shipped to a patient's house. McCullough argues that Tennessee Oncology's pharmacy is still best suited to serve its own patients.
These medications need management. Patients need to be closely monitored. Patients need a relationship with their healthcare provider.
But PBMs have been cutting into the business, and major cancer clinics around the country have been collecting grievances from patients in order to get Congress to rein in the PBM industry. Nicole Pankey lives outside Nashville. She's become one of the cautionary tales in all this. She didn't even know who her PBM was until CVS Caremark started second-guessing her prescriptions, like one designed to prepare her body for chemo.
It causes my bone marrow to produce more white blood cells.
The 41-year-old mother was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer last year. She wanted to start chemo right away to give her the most time to see her kids grow up. She needed a drug that runs $500 a dose. Her PBM required her to use its pharmacy, but the drug was out of stock.
They called me and said, "Oh, we can't fill your prescription. I'm sorry." And I was like, "Excuse me?" I was not happy with that answer.
Pankey spent hours on the phone, and eventually CVS Caremark, which did not respond to requests for comment, agreed to pay for the medication at the doctor's pharmacy, so her chemo regimen stayed on track.
The thing is I pushed. I'm strong enough to push and say, no, that's not an acceptable answer to me, that this is my life.
And she points out not everyone would put up a fight.
No, I don't know that my mother would do that.
PBMs are easy targets. They sometimes question what a patient's doctor has prescribed or suggest a lower-cost alternative. And lawmakers have scrutinized how cozy they've become with pharmaceutical companies. Top executives have even been called to testify to Congress this year, where they've made a case for their existence. Derek Arise is the president of CVS Caremark.
Over the last 3 years, we have saved our clients and their members $141 billion in drug costs.
The middleman role is helpful, says health policy professor Stacy Dusitsina.
PBMs are really trying to help manage spending growth.
Dusitsina studies rising drug prices at Vanderbilt University. Cancer medication is a chief offender. She says cancer doctors and their pharmacies do need someone to make sure they go with the cheapest alternative that's still effective.
Which basically translates to trying to keep your premiums on your health insurance lower so that your employer can do things like pay you more rather than just paying for your health benefits.
It's just that cancer patients aren't thinking about their monthly insurance premiums when they run into a cost control measure standing between them and a potentially life-saving medication. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I sort of like black out from rage. I remember throwing the phone at him.
Financial decisions in hindsight. But first, let's do the numbers. What is Jay Powell thinking? That's what everybody on Wall Street wants to know. I'll tell you what he's thinking, by the way. 25 basis points. That's what he's thinking. Dow Industrials gained 28 points, 10th percent, 27,221. The NASDAQ off 36 points, about 4/10 percent, finished at 8,293. The S&P 500 down 4 points, about a 10th percent, 3,020 there. United Airlines announced it's buying a stake in Clear. That's the biometric screening firm whose technology is used by something like 4 million people to get through airport security lines. United stock up just a touch, under a 10th percent. Delta Airlines also owns a stake in Clear, up by about a 0.5% today. Whole slew of earnings reports on Wall Street today, but all eyes were on Beyond Meat, the maker of meat alternatives. Stock has been up 800% since its IPO in May, just over 2 months ago. The company raised its full 2019 outlook in earnings after the bell. Traders, not so much, down 12% after hours. That's on top of 5% to the downside during the day. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.05%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A lot of offices are emptier than usual this time of year, vacations and all. So you might be getting more out-of-office replies to your emails. And that is the inspiration for our occasional series, Automatic Replies, some of the more creative ways that people say, I'll get back to you later. This next one caught our ear because it gives a voice to the voiceless.
Hi, Steve let me to answer your email again. He wants you to know that he'll be on a cruise between May 12th and May 16th. He cannot guarantee that he'll have access to the internet, so he may not be able to respond to your message until the evening of Thursday, May 16th. Sorry about that, but don't blame me. I'm not bitter he never takes me anywhere. Really, after all, I'm just a piece of software. Sincerely. The autoresponder.
Steve Hale is a software project manager in Long Beach, California. You can tell us about an unusual automatic reply that you've gotten at marketplace.org. While their kids are growing up, parents make decisions, right? Decisions they think are the best in the moment. But Decisions that with some hindsight and when the kids have grown up might look different. That's especially true when it involves their financial lives. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that story.
When Haley McKnight was in high school, she remembers sitting at her computer filling out college financial aid forms. Both of her parents were out of work at the time, so she knew she'd likely get a lot of help. Plus, her grandfather, before he died, had opened a savings account for her education.
Dad is kind of standing behind me. So I told Dad, I said, hey, how much is in that college fund that was set up for me? I mean, last I heard, it was like $20,000, so it should be even more than that, right? And he looks at me and he goes, oh, there's about $100 in there. And I kind of dead stopped and I said, excuse me, what? Well, where is it? And he goes, well, how do you think we've been living all these years without me having a job?
Haley couldn't believe it. The thing is, her parents got divorced when she was six, and her dad had largely been raising her since. After he lost his job when she was 14, he kind of checked out. He'd spend the night at his girlfriend's a bunch, leaving Haley home alone, never really enforcing rules. So realizing that he took her college fund that her grandfather gave her as a gift, that was the last straw.
I sort of like black out from rage. I remember throwing the phone at him that had my mother on the other line and just kind of screaming at him.
Oh my gosh.
Just, I hate you. I can't believe you did this. That money was mine. You stole it from me.
Wow. So he just depleted your funds and you had no idea.
I had no idea that was happening.
For Haley, it was a defining moment, something that as you go through life, you return to again and again. Because really, it's the moment she started wrapping her identity with ideas of worth and money. And it's when she started drafting a new version of her dad in her head.
So to find out that, you know, the person that when you're a kid is supposed to be the parent is actually the one that stole this thing that made you feel like important. It definitely connected a couple of things in my mind that weren't there before. So now all of a sudden, after I move out on my own and have my own money, I'm going, you know, am I worth it?
It's a feeling that followed her through college. Even today, as a 30-something, it's hard for Haley to let go of what her dad did, you know, just blowing through her college fund behind her back, even if he didn't see it that way.
I always thought that she knew that we were spending that money, but I guess...
Why'd you think she knew that?
I guess she didn't. I don't know. I thought I'd told her. But at any rate, I guess I didn't. I don't know.
Haley's dad, Rick Carroll, lives in Lomita, a rural town in Texas, similar to where he raised Haley. When I ask him about her childhood, he gets straight to the money.
I don't think she knew that we were broke. I never wanted her to worry.
Yeah.
About money. And so hopefully she didn't. I don't think she did.
Rick says that after the divorce and getting laid off from his IT job, it was a struggle to pay bills and get food on the table.
So rather than me borrowing a bunch of money and getting in debt at, 11 or 12% or something like that, I just was drawing off of that fund. I didn't see any other way to maintain a lifestyle that either one of us would be comfortable with.
He knew his father had created the savings account specifically for Haley, but Rick felt like it was better to spend the money on her in the now instead of in the future for college. Do you think using that money was stealing?
No, not really. I wasn't spending it on me, and I was spending it on us. Just mainly just to live.
Over the last several years, Rick has been trying to make amends. He's contributed to Haley's student loan payments, and he helped her buy her first house. But for Haley, that still hasn't erased what he did. I think sometimes it's hard to let go of things that happened when we were younger, because often those things, like money, become emblematic of something much larger. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Rima's the host of our new podcast, This is Uncomfortable. This final note on the way out today, in which Fortnite puts an end to whatever remains of the are esports a real thing or not debate. Epic Games, the purveyor of the aforementioned esport Fortnite, hosted the Fortnite World Cup Finals this past weekend. First of all, the grand prize was $3 million. $3 million, won by a 16-year-old from Pennsylvania, by the by. But more to the business model point, on Twitch and YouTube, more than 2 million people concurrently were streaming that final. Might be even higher once Epic gives the final numbers. All right, we're out of here. The Dow Industrial's up 28 points today, about a 10th percent. The NASDAQ down 36 points, 0.4%. S&P 500 lost 4 points, about a 10th of 1% there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Schen. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andreas and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.